This podcast is proud to be part of the TalkSport Fan Network. TalkSport. Powered by fans.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
The TalkSport Fan Network is proudly supported by McDelivery, bringing you the food you love. McDelivery brings a top-tier lineup of food right to your door. No matter the result, you'll always be winning with McDelivery. So the only thing left to say is, you in? Order now on the McDonald's app. You can also get reward points delivered too. So the ordering today means some tasty rewards for tomorrow. Only via app at participating restaurants. 18 plus. Rewards registration required. Points only on menu items. Delivery fee and terms apply. See mcdonalds.com.
Back of the Nest. Match Review Podcast. www.backofthenest.com.
Hello and welcome to the Back of the Nest review show. I am Chris Hambling and I'm your host today as we look back at a 2-0 victory for Palace against Norwich City. Plenty to talk about, plenty of contact from you, and I'll introduce you to my panel in just a moment.
Reviews, predictions, comments and rants. Send us your voice clips on WhatsApp 0203 575 1266.
Right, let's talk to my panel first up. I mean, I've got, I suppose I get to start with him. It's Mr. DR Kernes. Hello, DR.
Hello.
How's things with you?
Yeah, it's good. Moved out. Living by myself now. So, yeah, it's first day in. I'm still alive. So, yeah, I'm thankful.
Are you in like a halls of residence?
Yep. Yes, I am. And it's different. Let me just say that.
Okay. Difference fine, difference good.
Surviving.
Any cooked any chicken this week?
That's on hold for now because I don't want to burn the place down.
Yeah, exactly.
this is like before. It's only me and my parents. So now there's way more people. So yeah, I have to take precautions when I do stuff. So yeah, I haven't done that yet, but hopefully next week I should.
Yeah, well. I look forward to that and other people staring at you incredulously when you're telling them that your chicken breast has been in there for 45 minutes or something ridiculous. Right, moving swiftly on. Chris Clark, hello.
Hello.
You all right?
Yeah, not too bad. It's been a pretty busy week. As you know, many of you will know, I'm a Labour councillor, so I spent half of the week just gone down in Brighton at the Labour Party conference. Went straight there from the Wolves game, which felt like a defeat and affected my perception of the week that was to follow. But yeah, good to be back on the show.
I mean, what goes on at a Labour Party conference, eh? Any exciting stories or things that you can't tell us?
There's a story for offline, but basically it's lots of political talk and drinking. It's a bit like the preview show, basically.
Excellent joke. I didn't even know I was setting you up for that, but it was good. I enjoyed it. Well done. And also, finally, it's Mr. Mike Scott. Hi, Mike.
Hello, you all right?
Yeah, I'm smashing, thanks. You?
I'm not bad. I haven't gone for the week to the Labour Party conference as much as I would have loved to have sat there for a week listening to people chat shit. But I have had an all right week. Nice curry last night, fairly easy going. Looking for a new job. She's stressing me out a little bit. Yeah, well, I mean, I just want some more money, really.
Should we explore what you're after with the listeners? So, Mike, time for you to sell yourself quickly. So, what are you looking for in terms of a job and a financial package?
Oh, well, yeah, I didn't think about using this medium. Well, I'd like a nice IT job on about a few grand more than what I'm on, preferably not so far away from where I live. But IT is, you hit a ceiling with IT, really, when you're in technical support. You sort of get to a certain point and you can't really go any further unless you start really specialising. So maybe I should do something else. Maybe I should get into like true crime podcasting as a full-time profession or something instead.
Well, I'm up for that, mate, if you want any support on that. Okay, obviously, if you want to get in touch with us, many of you are doing it the right way, which is to add your voice to a growing number of voices on WhatsApp. You can chuck our contact number 0203 575 1266 in your contacts, and you can send us messages, voice messages, videos, whatever you want. And well, not whatever you want, there are certain pictures we don't want to see, if you're so kind, but other than that, within reason, send us what you like, and you might well feature on the show. But of course, if you don't have social media, you're not on Twitter or Instagram or anything like that, there's a new thing called email, which is like a letter sent through through cyberspace, and you can just type. You don't have to go to the post office. You just do it through your internet browser. And our email address is hi@backofthenest.com. We also have a new podcast. It launched last week, called Your View, where we get a collection of your contact from the WhatsApp voice messages. And just package those together so everyone can get a flavour of how everyone else is feeling, and hopefully start getting some debate going on that as well. They get released on Tuesday evenings at 7 p.m. We also want to once again mention that Back of the Nest is in the top 40 of the best-selling football podcasts ever. And obviously we don't sell it, but you know what I mean? And so it just, at this point, we'd like to take the opportunity to thank you for that. Thank you for your regular downloads. Please continue to share and obviously rate the podcast as highly as humanly possible, which really does spread the word and help us progress. Anyway, let's get on with talking about the game. So first up, I and many others had a, should we say, negative reaction when the lineup was announced. But rather than listen to me repeat myself in terms of explaining that, got a couple of clips now coming right up from two of our valued listeners.
Afternoon, Darren here.
And well,
same old turgid crap being churned out yet again at home. There's nothing on there that screams out attacking to me. Townsend's on the bench, Myers on the bench, and I'm assuming that Camarasa was a hologram and a ruse, and he didn't really get signed at all. I mean, what's the poor geezer got to do? He played really well for Cardiff last season, and it's almost as if it's like a graveyard. Come to Palace to do nothing and sit on your backside, get cast out. It's so disheartening every week. And, you know, it's almost as if Roy's so stubborn and set in his ways that he just does not want to change a thing.
Hi, Daniel again. Just seeing the lineup. Yeah, no creativity in the middle of the park again. Gonna be an interesting day.
Well, there we go. I mean, just to emphasise the point, I know we're starting with this, but we did win the game, and we are very happy about that. And we'll be talking about all the positives throughout the course of the show. But I think it's really interesting for us to get into that reaction, because I had the same reaction myself, and I kind of made the point that I felt that I almost didn't think it was relevant whether or not we went on to win the game because of what the selection kind of showed us. Now, interestingly, the way the game panned out, I feel a little bit differently now. But and I do want to say I really enjoyed Darren's comment that he suspects that Camarasa might actually be a hologram. So cheers for that, Darren. Certainly nowhere to be seen at the moment. But you know, I've got my views on that. But let's hear from Chris next.
So I'm much less downbeat than, I mean, I always play this role of the kind of more optimistic person, and that's genuinely because that's what I think. So let's start with Camarasa. We have not yet seen what he's capable of in a Palace shirt when he has come on. Which is maybe once, I think, having from the games I've been at, which is all except one, he hasn't impressed me. That's not to say that he won't go on to have a spectacular Palace career, but he hasn't had the opportunity thus far. So I'm going to hold judgment on whether it's the right or wrong thing. Townsend, I've been sad to see him dropped. And I can understand the immediate negativity. I particularly enjoyed Hesketh jumping in on Twitter with the three DMs, three defensive midfielders in a starting 11 in a home game against a potential rival in terms of league position at the end of the season. But then actually, when you think about both, I've got two things I want to say about this. First is, I think MacArthur, we missed his energy hugely when he hasn't played for us thus far this season, and he's proved a lot of us wrong in terms of wondering for probably about a year or more now about whether he's passed it. Coyote, I think, is a really important addition to our team as well. And then finally, with regard to Jeffrey Schlupp, I'm a well-documented fan of his, but I actually think he had a really good game yesterday, and I think he made some very important attacking moves down the left-hand side, and he could easily have scored a goal as well. So I'm not in with the negativity about that selection. I was not delighted, but I certainly wasn't worried when I saw that team come out. And yeah, I'm interested to hear others' views.
Well, when you talk about negativity, I think there's sort of two areas you can come from. The first is if you're being negative about a chance of watching really fun free-flowing football, and there was a couple of people were mentioning, oh, why am I going to Selhurst today? All I get is boredom and misery. You know, they're joking, but I think people's objection was they didn't want another sort of a display where it was a ground out 1-0. But what I would say is that defensively, I'm not sure before yesterday, but certainly after the game, still the best defence so far in the Premier League. So it's hard to say Roy has done the wrong thing by selecting defensive midfielders from that point of view. So if people are talking about it from the sort of how you watch a game of football and enjoying it, fair enough. But I wouldn't say I was upset with any of the choices he made. Kelly was something that had to happen because Saka was injured. IU started rather than Benteke, so I was happy with that. We didn't lose last game against a side that are in the Europa League. So, you know, you've got to look at the positives. And I think most people, it was more about not getting to see some sort of glittering free-flowing football than anything else.
I agree with Mike, but with Camarasa, it's just, when is he going to get the opportunity to really show himself? You look at the bench and you got Scott Dan and James Tompkins there, both on the bench. And this was the case last week against Wolves as well, where you had Martin Kelly and Scott Dan there, I believe. So we always decide to go with two centre-halves on the bench. And I feel like that's going to limit Camarasa's opportunities because we're not in a cup competition for him to come out and show himself. So where does it really fit in if Roy continues to do the same thing? And that's the only thing I'm slightly worried about, because we've got him out on loan. He has potential to be a good player because, yes, he's done that with Cardiff, but I feel like we've got a better squad than Cardiff, so he might even be able to do even more with our squad. But it seems like he's not really going to get the opportunity unless an injury happens, and you don't want other players to be injured. But that's the only case. I don't see Roy giving him an opportunity without it.
I think what's really important to sort of understand in the discussions over Camarasa and Max Meyer still as well, because I mean, a lot of people will be saying, yeah, well, you know, Meyer hasn't pulled up any trees when he has played. Roy started him at the beginning of the season and he lost his place when Schlupp came back. And it's pretty clear and we might talk about this more later on, but it's pretty clear from Roy's comments this week that, I don't know, again, I speculate that he listens, because every time I laid into Schlupp last week about him not being a central midfielder, and this week Roy's talking about how people underrate him and, you know, doesn't get the respect he deserves and all that kind of stuff. So, sharp, Roy. But anyway, the point I'm actually angling towards making is that with players like Camarasa and Meyer, the problem I have with it, and the reason I think that, you know, whilst Roy is here, we are going to struggle to see them in any meaningful way, is that Roy won't change the system to accommodate the different skill set. You know, he has the way that he wants to play, and the players that he selects kind of week in, week out are the ones he trusts to do it. And it's very difficult for a player to come in because they have to basically play like the person that they're replacing, because they're going to be judged accordingly. And you know, Max Meyer coming onto the pitch, he's not going to play like Kouyaté, he's not going to play like Luka Milivojevic, and he's not going to play like James McArthur, and he certainly is going to play like Jeffrey Schlupp. So without, unless we, or you know, by we I mean the coaching staff, change something to look at how Meyer plays football, he's not going to play on a regular basis. Now, unfortunately, I think the same goes for Camarasa.
I think our recruitment needs to slightly change as well if Roy Hodgson decides to remain as a manager from this season onwards, because it's obvious that he, what type of transfers he wanted. He clearly wanted McCarthy. He's put him on a couple of times this season. He also wanted Gary Cahill. You could see that by him starting. But players like Camarasa, and you think about the tactics, for example, it doesn't fit into his style of play. And I feel like we're wasting money for no reason. I don't think we should force it anymore and try to get creative players just for the sake of it. I think we should just get players that Roy 100% approves on, because we're going to end up in a situation where we're just wasting money on wages for no reason. I mean, we've got a good enough squad to keep Camarasa out. Okay, fair enough. But we could have got someone, and we could have paid way less for someone else. And that would have been much better, personally.
Well, I agree with the point you're making in terms of making sure that the manager wants the players you get. And I dare say that you're you know, we don't know the full story, but I would suggest that you're probably right in saying that there were other players that Roy was much more keen to get, and it's clear that those players are in the starting lineup. You know, he was clearly keen to get Gary Cahill, and rightly so. We'll talk more about Gary Cahill today. Very keen to get IU in, and he was, you know, hugely keen to get James McCarthy in. But you know, you would speculate perhaps not so keen to get someone like Camarasa in, who, but you know, again, bottom line is the players do have to earn their way into the team, and they've got to play well enough when they get there. It's just, you know, like you're kind of hinting at, DR, Roy's not going to change. So, but that, look, it there are positives and negatives to that way of playing. So let's get more into the actual game and some of the incidents that happened within it. And we'll start by hearing from Daniel again.
Hi, this is Daniel again. Just back home in Woolwich from the Palace Norwich game. It is an interesting game. We still lack a lot of creativity, and I feel that might be a problem with sides that decide that they're going to be sitting back against us. Norwich try to be very open. They pass the ball pretty well. I think that we actually won that game in the middle of the park. I think that we were putting in some strong challenges. We didn't give them a real opportunity to settle and get their passing game on. Kouyaté is unbelievable, and I am so glad that he's actually playing for us, because he is the legs in that in the middle of the park. Same with James McArthur. I think he had a good game, but yeah, we won it because we were able to really out battle them in the middle of the park, basically.
So it's good comments there from Daniel. Enjoyed that that review. Still, it is a little bit more down than I expected. A little bit more philosophical, perhaps, than a 2-0 victory directly afterwards you might feel that someone would be. However, I think there's some good insight in there. Particularly, I'd like to comment about the midfield, because the midfield for me was the huge positive. It was the thing that frustrated me perhaps the most in not killing Wolves off. Because it was very flat, and again, you go back to perhaps particularly the first half against Spurs, where the midfield three were very tight together, very very static in a line, and that gap between defence and midfield was just exploited by Spurs in a quite horrific way for us to watch. And we had none of that really against Norwich, other than for the period of the first half. Probably last 20 minutes of the first half, where we got under pressure, and they did that, and they dropped into that sort of tight three formation, which really doesn't look good. The midfield was so much more positive. You had McArthur popping up in and around the box, which is obviously how we got the penalty. Kouyaté the same on the sort of left-hand side of the three. But they, you know, the movement, the sort of interchange of position, and the fact that Luke got to sit there and be much more of the kind of, I don't want to call it the quarterback role, but that kind of linchpin, if you like, in midfield. I felt that was so much more positive. And it really did surprise me, because I went into the game, as we talked about earlier, with that, can't believe we've gone with the same selection again. What are we expecting anything to be any different? But it was different. The game plan was different. The emphasis was different. The tempo was different. And it came from that midfield.
Exactly. And you have to give credit to Roy Hodgson for that, I think, because even Martin Kelly after the game, he said that we had a game plan today to press them from the front and not give Norwich any time on the ball. That's what he said to the official Palace website after the game. And you saw it there. I feel like Roy Hodgson's tactic going into the game and instruction to the players, especially the midfield, it worked out fantastically, because even from what I've seen from Norwich, they don't change their style of play. Every game, they will try to play out from the back. And if we decided to go with our usual tactics, which was play on the counter, I feel like we might have struggled this game. But Roy Hodgson actually changed it up. And just like the Tottenham game where me and you argued, Hambo, I feel like he's adjusted and he's done the right thing. And this time he has paid off. As I said in that game, sometimes it will pay off, sometimes it won't. And this time Roy's tactics did, and you have to give him credit.
And on the same note, it's important to make the point that normally what happens, of course, is that we get these press quotes from Roy saying we were better second half. In this case, we were clearly well set up in the first half and we dominated for the first 20-25 minutes. Once the goal had gone in, things changed a little bit, and that's something I'm sure we'll talk about in terms of analysing what happened after the goal and the pressure we were put under and withheld. But I think it's important to just give credit to the fact that we had a game plan, which was to play hard rather than sit back as we normally do, and it worked.
Well, I think, I mean, we can talk about that now a little bit, because I'm very interested in what that was in terms of the drop off in the first half, because as you say, we're set up very well, and Roy got it absolutely spot on from the start. But that reaction after the goal, where we've been critical, and I in particular have been critical of Roy in the past about this, you know, the negative attitude. I don't think I certainly can't blame Roy for that reaction to us scoring a goal. And it does point to there being a mentality situation with the players. And that comes from, I guess, from losing late goals on a couple of occasions and a couple of poor performances, perhaps. But I think the way the midfield did drop back and tuck in and become very, very narrow, you know, I'm less convinced that that's a specific instruction when we're trying to keep it tight. And perhaps it's more of a natural reaction that the players are having. And perhaps that's what keeps getting corrected at half time in order to make us have those better second halves. And there was certainly something up between MacArthur and Milivojevic towards the end of the first half, which would indicate they weren't doing what they were supposed to be doing.
Yeah, I think you're spot on that he corrected it at half time. But I think it's important to note that I haven't really noticed us going into our shells in that way after we've gone ahead very much this season. I mean, that's partly because we haven't gone ahead very much, but it seems to me that it's hard. I know you talked about it in the press conference, as you say, a fair bit, how Norwich had their best 20 minutes of the game after Milivojevic's goal. But I think it's hard to read too much into it because, A, that was the only period in the game that they had it, really. I mean, it wasn't a second half time where things got nervy, you know, towards the end, where you'd think maybe they've got in their heads, oh, this is what happened against Wolves, we might concede. It didn't look that way in the second half. So I wonder if it's enough to be dissecting it too much just because Norwich had a good 20 minutes out of 95.
I think that's a really good point. And I think the last thing I really want to say on what we're currently talking about, to go back to something that DR was pointing out about, you know, pressing Norwich high. And I think that's something that we've got to learn from, because it does suit us a little bit more than perhaps you might think. And the main reason is if we're pressing high, it means the midfield is automatically having to push up the pitch. And that makes it so much easier for us when we're having these games where we've got more of the ball and we're not playing on a break. It makes it so much easier for us to move the ball quickly and create an opportunity. And we were still a little bit, you know, as Daniel was saying in his clip, there was still a little bit of a struggle to properly create. And I really, you know, Wilf was probably the difference in that, in the terms, because, you know, he was absolutely on fire periods in that game, and really, you know, made the difference between us spending a long time with the ball and creating nothing and us creating a few key chances. But, you know, that's not to damn the club or the manager with faint praise. We used the players we got effectively and came out winning the game, which it was a hugely important game with the run we've got coming up against some very, very good teams over the next six games. So let's talk a little bit about the goals. So obviously the penalty came from what we've discussed, which is a midfielder getting into the box, Wilf playing the ball to James McArthur. He touched it away from goal, and former Palace target Ibrahim Amadou clattering into McArthur. I saw on, I think it was Sky Sports News or something like that, it was referred to as a controversial penalty. Did anyone see it as a controversial penalty?
So obviously during the game, it's miles away from E Block of the Homesdale, so it was hard to see. But looking back, he didn't really. He took him out, but there was no follow through. It's sort of hard to explain without seeing it, but there was no follow through in his leg whatsoever. So he stopped himself. He sort of checked himself from knocking him over. So I would say anywhere else on the pitch is a, you know, good argument to say that it wasn't a penalty. The fact that he gave it, John Moss gave it, meant that VAR wasn't going to overturn it, because a bit like when you're watching the cricket and the ball just, you know, manages to just touch the bales. It was once you've given it, it's hard to overturn it because it's half a dozen of one, six of the other. So I can see why it's controversial. Norwich were shouting VAR. Didn't hear that at the time, but heard it back on the TV replays. And then, you know, went to VAR and it's fine. Interestingly, I think that the one that Zahar got knocked over seems just as much of a penalty as that one.
Yeah, I'd say for sure. That's definitely the approach to VAR at the moment, isn't it? They're going to go with whatever the ref says unless it's really clear that it's not the case. I agree. I think Wilf's perhaps even more of a penalty. It was a clumsy challenge, and they did a really good bit on Goals on Sunday where they talked about the reaction of the defensive team as much as the attacking team and the players and how they react. And most of Norwich's players immediately within a split second of the challenge going in, looked at the ref. And that tells you that, you know, there was enough contact for that to have been a legitimate foul. Although I can see, you know, obviously McArthur was definitely, as soon as that contact was there, he was definitely going down to ground to get that penalty.
There was a couple of VAR incidents in yesterday's game. If you watch at home, you probably would have noticed them. But people always, it seems like majority are slating VAR recently. But yesterday's game, you have to give credit to VAR and Jonathan Moss on how he used VAR, because I feel like Jonathan Moss' performance without the VAR was poor and how he managed the game. But in terms of VAR stopping the game, everything seemed so smoothly. It happened more than two occasions, I'm pretty sure of that. And yeah, you have to give credit to VAR there. But on the downside of the refereeing yesterday is the fact that there were times, there was just one incident where there was a Norwich player who was actually off the field and the Norwich players went to have a water break. And I just don't, like, your Premier League referee, you should have control over the game. You should say play on. It doesn't matter if he's off the field, he's getting treated there. And that's the one thing that annoyed me, but it was nothing to do with VAR. It was just Jonathan Moss himself and it was just so poor from him.
And I just wanted to go back to the Wilf penalty incident, because I was absolutely convinced it looked really obvious. But obviously, we're at the far end of the pitch from that in terms of where we stand. So was it as clear and obvious as it looked on the telly? For some bizarre reason, it wasn't even picked up in the highlights that are on the Palace website, which I've watched back. But I would have thought there was a scope for a VAR review on that, and it didn't happen.
Well, I don't know. I don't always seem to know if they actually have VAR reviewed some of these things. If play doesn't stop, it seems to get sort of reviewed. It doesn't go up on the screen because play's carrying on. I think it was looked at and refused. In fact, I know it was looked at and refused. But it looked, it's difficult not to look at it with bias, though, isn't it? I don't know how a neutral would view it. I thought it was a penalty because it was a slightly mistimed challenge. But you know, I've seen far worse challenges of that, and Wilf go unpunished as well. So I guess it's difficult to tell.
I downloaded the Sky half hour highlights, and the two commentators came to the conclusion that it wasn't a penalty. It did get reviewed, and it wasn't overturned. So you know, it's hard to argue with at least three sources. What I wanted to bring up was, from watching those 30-minute highlights, it was interesting that it came across that Norwich were hard done by John Moss, because while I was at the game, it felt like we were hard done by John Moss, and he made some terrible decisions. He got the old, you don't know what you're doing, who's the wicker in the black, and it felt thoroughly justified. So it's weird how you can take highlights that are, you know, probably a quarter of the length of the full length of the game, and they can make it seem like it's totally the opposite to what you saw when you watched the full 90 at the stadium. Very odd.
I mean, Moss is just a terrible ref for everybody, but when certainly when you're in the ground, it'll always feel worse for you. I think you're right. It did look hard on Norwich, but I think we all know the truth. So look, plenty happened in between, but there's not really anything to pick out in any major way. So let's talk about the injury time goal, because it was a thing of beauty. You know, Max Meyer was on the pitch, received the ball on the left hand side, and the pass is absolutely exquisite. He's facing away towards his defence, and in one motion is just sort of span and put a brilliant curling ball down the line. But it shouldn't be underestimated how good the anticipation and run from Wilfried Zaha is as well, because the two aren't looking at each other. You know, they're it's almost telepathic, knowing what Mayer was going to do, and Wilf reading that. So absolutely superb. Brilliant skill from Wilf, very much vintage Wilfried Zaha. Runs past the defence, and it was picked up again, I think Goals on Sunday said it, where it might have even been Sam Allardyce, I think it was Sam, who said that a few years back, even maybe a couple of years back, Wilfried Zaha always shoots when he comes across the goal like that. Absolutely, he's going to take a shot, and every now and then maybe one will go in. But the maturity he plays with these days means that he picked out Andros with a lovely pass. Andros, plenty of time to control it. Good finish and drilled it in. So a really pleasing goal. Obviously, it took a lot of pressure off, and you could certainly see on the sidelines that the coaching staff in particular were nervous watching the team see it out. But very, very positive. And I thought it's interesting seeing Roy's comments on Andros Townsend afterwards, because obviously Andros has lost his place, and a lot of people have talked about him being in poor form. But it was kind of, well, it was confirmed that both the club in terms of the management staff and Andros himself agreed with that assessment, that he had been poor and he hadn't been contributing and he did deserve to lose his place in the team. And that's very much a step in the right direction to see him come back. We'll talk about the subs in a bit, but I thought it was an excellent goal and relieved. And I was unfortunately unable due to illness to be in the ground, but Mike, Chris, how did you greet that particular winner?
I mean, it went off, definitely. It kind of looked like it was coming for a fairly long period. Once for the last 20 minutes with the personnel change, it didn't really look at any point like Norwich were going to get one back, but then it didn't really look like that for Wolves the week before. I think what people really liked about it was the link up Mayo Wilf Townsend, and you're looking at the sort of a flair three that the starting lineup was missing. So that to an extent gave people that were already moaning the justification to say, well, that's what Palace should be doing. But that was a product of Norwich being worn, really heavily worn down. I mean, they were run ragged. So the goal was a product of being late on in the game and there being a lot of space. It's good that he knows how to exploit these kind of situations, but you wouldn't have got that goal 15 minutes into the game.
One thing that I was actually impressed by was the fact that I think a few minutes before that, we had a corner and we decided to take a short corner instead of going for the second goal. And Roy Hodgson and the players did talk about that after the game and how they talked about in the lead up to the game that they could do better in game management. And that's one thing that I was very impressed by. But with Andros, I think this season he... I don't blame Roy Hodgson for dropping him because his performances has been below par. But one thing that I did pick up when he did come on yesterday was the fact that he decided to cross more on his right with his right foot on the right-hand side instead of cutting in. And I think that's going to help him a lot if he can continue doing that because his game was predictable. It was the fact that he just, on the right-hand side, cuts to the left-hand side and teams have figured him out. But now, if he does that, I think he can be more of a threat. And like that, he could find his place back in the starting 11.
Definitely, although we all know how he'd be accommodated in that starting 11. We'll talk about that in a bit. Okay, just to sort of see off the sort of reaction to the game itself, let's get a couple more listener clips now. We'll start with one from Ebo.
Hello, Ebo again, after match. Happy with that result. Hard work, though, a little bit. Again, we go 1-0 up. And just seems like we seem to drop deep then and just invite Norwich on, which was a bit scary because they look quite good on the break. Still very frustrated with the fact that we don't try and play someone a bit creative in midfield. I thought Macca was the best of the midfield three. QI ran around a lot, but I don't know, did anyone notice the constant arguing between Macca and Luca from about, I don't know, towards the last 10 minutes of the first half? It was a bit weird. Don't know what was going on there. Great when he brought Andros on. Gave us a little bit more impetus. That was good. And the link up with Wilf at the end for that goal, which was just at the right time, really, because it looked like we were going to go and do what we did against Villa and do what we did against Wolves and concede a last-minute goal, which would have been a real kick in the teeth, really. I don't know. I'm happy with the result. Going into the international break, that's always good to go around there with a win. I think that means Luca's on a ban for the next match as well. I think he picked up a yellow at the end there. So that'll be interesting to see what happens without him being able to be in midfield. But I would imagine it just means that he's going to put MacArthur, and Kiarte in the middle. And I've got to say, I was a little bit disappointed with Jeffrey Schlupp. I don't really know what he adds to the team. But anyway, 2-0. Happy with that.
So thanks, Ebo. I called you Ebo again. I've got to stop doing that. I'm going to have to write it in my show notes with many more E's so I say it correctly. But yeah, a few interesting points in there. I think in particular, I mentioned it earlier, the slight disagreement, it seemed, between MacArthur and Luca. But interested he picked out MacArthur as the stronger performer over Kouyaté, because I thought both were excellent. He's absolutely right to pick the two out. But for me, Kouyaté was slightly the stronger. But and I also just want to suggest that, yes, Luca is out. The international break is an extra week, isn't it? We've got West Ham first. And, my opinion is, right, we won't see McCarthy come into the side. We'll see Andros come into the side and someone else drop from the front three into the central midfield area, and I'll leave it at that.
I think Ebo he made a really very good point with the Luca thing, because we've talked about it in a couple of games where when we suffer defeat and we're asking who's the leader of this team, and this is not the only game that Luca's done this. I've seen Luca argue with Wolf a lot in the past. So yesterday with MacArthur, I think at one point he argued with Joe Ward, and that's what you need. You need players out there that actually care and that have passion. You're on a football pitch, and the fact that Luke has taken other players accountable and questioning them, that's what you need, because there's been so many games this season where after the game we're talking about, all right, who was the leader there? Why was there no passion? And Luke, as a captain, I feel like he's doing a great job in taking other people accountable, and I think it works out well in the end as well.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. and they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Away days are great, but there's nothing quite like playing at home. The same goes for McDonald's. Maximize your home ground advantage with McDelivery. You in? Order now on the McDonald's app. At participating restaurants, 18 plus, serving times, delivery fee and terms apply. See mcdonalds.com.
Afternoon, gents. Darren here. Just the second half is just finished. Had a few minutes to digest what was going on. Couple of things towards the end of the game. You know, we all said last week about game management and seeing out the end of the game. Wilf has three or four players on him down by their corner flag, still manages to retain possession. Killer cut the seconds there. Within about the 86th minute, I look up at the telly and Luke has gone down with cramp and Gary Cahill decides he's going to have a little sit down in the box. I mean, I know there's like game management and seeing out the end of the game. But then 30 seconds after that, we bring on our last substitution and Max Meyer comes on. You know, it's like it's all or nothing. We had nothing last week and now all of a sudden we're doing everything this week. World pleased for Andros coming on and getting the second goal. I think it was nice to see a positive substitution.
Well, there we go. Nice to see a positive substitution. Well, we'll come to that particular topic in just a moment. But thanks for your comments there, Darren. And thanks to everyone who sent in their reactions. Obviously, check the podcast. Your view out it comes out on Tuesday for the full clips and the full details of everybody's reaction there. But I won't expand any more on that. We'll get into our second topic, which Mike is going to take us through now.
I can certainly do that for you, no problem. And I think one of the main things that came out of yesterday's game was our defence, really. Obviously, Sacco was injured again. Not sure how severe that is, but it meant that Cahill and Kelly were the starting two. So I think the real discussion point, Cahill, Dan and Kelly definitely would be considered the backups to the start of the season. I know a few people were a little bit bemused that we signed Cahill. I think they've probably all changed their mind by now. They've all been good. They've all been great. I mean, Dan probably not quite ripped up as many trees as the other two. But I think the question is whether Roy has a sort of happy headache. With Tompkins back, he was on the bench yesterday, unused sub. What's he going to do? So Cahill was absolutely incredible. I think he was, for me, he was summed up by there was one cross, excellent cross, and the sinews of his neck kind of bent as he leapt up to head a ball out for a throw that otherwise would have fallen at whichever striker it was. I think it was the young guy with the floppy hair. I can't remember his name. I mean, he was excellent again. So comment from Jafar Jar 8 on Twitter saying absolutely loving Gary Cahill. Not only his leadership and defending, but his passion as well. What a signing. That sums it up pretty well. And then Chiles Meyer. Sacco was dropped for Kelly. I mean, that's not quite true because he was injured. But as he has been all season, Kelly was an absolute rock in defence. Would you allow Kelly to keep his shirt over Sacco at this point, or for that matter, over Tompkins?
I think if you drop Kelly right now, you're sending a wrong message to the rest of the squad. Yes, Sacco is the better player. But right now, Kelly is on form and he should start ahead of Sacco until Sacco is fit. And then when Sacco gets his opportunity, if he takes it well, then yes, it will be his position. But for now, I'll take Kelly over Sacco. And another thing that I want to talk about is Gary Cahill. Yes, he had a fantastic game yesterday, but I don't know if others have noticed, but over the last couple of home games, when I've, because of West Ham and Blocky, you get to see the whole pitch. And when Cahill is on our side, especially, you can see that he's the alpha of this team. I think even when Saka comes back, that thing won't change, because even last game when Saka was there alongside Cahill, Cahill's still the vocal player. And next game where Luka's dropped, I think, yes, it is. You might argue that it's early days, but I'll give Cahill the captaincy because his passion, yes, is brilliant, but he's a true leader on the pitch. He really is. And, I mean, what a signing he's been. But in terms of the headache as well that you mentioned, I think it is, yeah, Roy does have a headache, but it's a good combination because if you look at Roy's tactics, we've criticised him for being too defensive, but now he's got the quality players there to execute his defensive plans. And I feel like overall, this our back line and the options that we have, it just worked out so well for Roy Hodgson because it just plays into his game plan.
And I think what we've got to decide is which roles we want players to perform. I think it's fairly clear that both Sacco historically has been a very vocal player, calling people to line up in the correct positions and telling them where to stand for free kicks and corners and so on. Cahill does that too. And we've already seen that there have been clashes when the two of them have been playing that role. So it may be that we require one player who is the leader, the lead central defender, and then the other one. And at the moment, Kelly is the other one. It may be that once Tompkins is fit, if he can retain fitness, then he becomes that second centre-back. But for me, that's the structure that you've got, and it's pretty much an invidious choice between those. That's my take on it.
Well, the only other thing I wanted to add into the mix was, it seems to me, so I had a look on whoscored.com at Cahill's heat map, and it looked very much like he was shepherding PVA a little bit with his positioning throughout the game. So is it, regardless of how much you'd call him an alpha, say he was put in a position where he was asked by Roy to look after PVA and Sacco was looking after Ward? I mean, that could potentially work as well. I mean, I guess it's all speculation because we don't know how these people work together as teammates. So we're kind of guessing, really, by what we see on the pitch from them shouting at each other. But
I think it's you're right, it's difficult to judge. I mean, Cahill won't have a specific job to organise PVA, particularly as he's 28, 29, has been playing football for a long time, PVA, and should know what his job is. You know, people might argue that on the evidence of some of his positioning, but you know, he is an attacking fullback, and his mindset's always of that ilk. But Gary Cahill was the type of player, you know, an out and out leader, an out and out organizer who will organize whoever's next to him. I think there's potentially a conflict there with Sacco, who likes to do the same and also likes to be the left sided centre back. So I think you've got a bit of an issue there. For me, you cannot entertain the idea of whilst he's at the football club of Sacco not being first choice centre back with Cahill. I think Cahill is a better centre back than Kelly, Dan, and in all honesty, probably Tompkins as well. But I think Sacco is on his day, he's equal, if not slightly better. So that's my personal view of it. But having said all that, when you look at the evidence of admittedly one game in particular, comparing sort of the game we played against Wolves, it definitely looked more comfortable having Cahill alongside Kelly, and Kelly's performance was excellent. So there's an argument to say you don't drop something that works, you don't drop players who play well, and I don't think you could have asked any more from Kelly or from Cahill in that
there game. Was some random bloke on Twitter, and I'm sorry I haven't got it in front of me, hopefully you know who you are and you get all the credit, suggesting, supposing we were to have three centre-backs, you know, playing possibly in terms of strength of squad, centre midfield and centre backs are the places we're most strong with. So would two wing backs and three at the back be something that Roy would entertain or not? I don't know if he would, but definitely, you know, we could have three excellent centre backs.
Yeah, but do we have two excellent wing backs?
Well, that's the question. Yeah, Joe Ward as wing back would be an interesting thought.
All right. I'm not going to disrespect Ward this week. I think he did very well. He's looked very solid of late. Yeah, other than the incident from last week of trying to head a ball on the ground, which is not what you want to do, really, is it? So, should we talk substitutes, I guess? So, I suppose the first question that we've got from Rob_2 on Twitter says that the fact that Roy hasn't brought on Benteke, has he finally seen the light? Gives us that opportunity, I guess, to talk about Benteke. There was a tweet I saw for possibly an article or some sort of opinion piece from Sky Sports saying, how do you solve a problem like Benteke? And quite a lot of people suggesting that to not play him is the way to solve the problem. We talked last week at length about the fact that he's very much gone. But I guess the question is, do we look at the fact that when IU came off, it wasn't automatic that Roy went to Benteke, that Roy's decided that even people who aren't strikers are possibly now a better option to put out on the pitch? I'm not so sure. It's a tough one.
I think after the game against Wolves, you saw the two fingers to the fans, where I think he was talking about the striker options and how he hasn't got many. You can see that he now understands that you can't play Benteke just for the sake of him trying to get a new contract and try and get his form back. I think he made the right decision. I think I said it in the last pod, I can't remember, or it was on Love Sport, that I'm done with experimenting with Benteke. Because I don't think there's a way back for him, especially under Roy Hodgson. But the substitution, actually, taking IU off on Maya, that was a bit questionable. I find that a bit confusing because I didn't really expect that. I thought he would have went for more of a defensive approach. Well, of course, it did work out at the end because Maya was involved with scoring with the second goal. But again, Roy doing something unexpected, and that's something that I've been calling for a very long time, do something different, and he's doing it.
I mean, I felt like that substitute was more to kill time than anything else. But I feel like Benteke isn't really the issue to discuss, because the reason he didn't come on is simply that IU was really good. And there's no need to take off a fully fit striker that's looking threatening. So you can have an informed striker on the bench, but if you've got a decent one on the pitch, I mean, you shouldn't take him off, surely.
No, I think that's a really good point. I think that at times, I think Ayew's demeanour actually makes him look perhaps more tired than he is at times. He sort of hits that sort of 60, 65 minute mark. He's usually picked up a yellow card and he's usually got a look on his face. It looks like he's dead on his feet. But, you know, there was a point where I thought he was going to get taken off, and then he went on this storming run down the right-hand side. You think, oh, okay, fair enough. You're not quite as tired as you look then. And it was good to see him on for as long as he was to get a 90 minutes under his belt. But is it... Oh, go on, Chris.
I think Mike's right about the 90 minutes. It was mainly a substitution intended to consume time. But the other thing that you've got to remember is that, you know, we have a history of putting, or Roy has a history specifically, of putting Townsend and Zaha up as the two front prongs of a deeper lying midfield. So, you know, and I think that's kind of what we saw with what happened in the end of the game.
Well, kind of, yeah. I mean, Roy, Wilf was definitely central, and Mayer had taken that left-hand side position. But I think that takes us neatly into talking about the subs in general, because as much as I am very, very positive about the result and very, very happy with the performance, there was just a little thing in this sort of the way these subs came about that grated me a little bit. And now you can probably argue that, and I really want to emphasise the words I used there, a little bit, because it was a tiny amount. But That first substitution where Andros Townsend is coming on. Now, you can't criticise the fact that Andros has come on pitch because he's a very good player. We needed a bit of an impetus. We needed something to change. And he ended up scoring the second goal. So, looks like a good sub. Where I have, I'm going to tiptoe through this carefully, where I have a slight issue is, well, let's look at it. So Coyote is the player he replaces, right? So in my opinion, unless the system's changing, which it didn't, unless the system's changing, if you're taking off Coyote, you should be looking for a central midfielder to come on. There's a couple available on the bench there, you know, one who didn't make the bench. Or if you're looking for to get specifically get Townsend on the pitch, and you're not changing the system, then you've got to look to one of those wide players or even the centre forward to come off the pitch. So the substitution he made of taking off Cheick Coyote, putting on Andros Townsend, just so Jeffrey Schlupp could remain on the pitch in central midfield, it grates me. Because I said it before, I rate Jeffrey Schlupp as a footballer. I think he is a good footballer, in particularly when he's playing on the left-hand side. And I really like him in the wide left of a three. I don't like him as a central midfielder. And it grates the hell out of me that he's still seen as a better option in central midfield than Max Meyer, Victor Camarasa, James McCarthy. Anyone else? I don't know. You get what I'm getting at. So no one's suggesting they want to argue with me. But does anybody want to argue with me?
I had this argument with you before, haven't I? Regarding the pace issue. I think you're saying Jeffrey Schlupp's not a midfielder, and I agree. But he didn't start Jeffrey Schlupp in midfield. He moved him there for how long? Let me see when the substitution was.
But
I think
around
20 minutes. Yeah, it's 20 minutes. We was in control of the game. He decided to go with the pace option, and it's nothing changed. We still had control over the game, so I was not too worried about it. And against the Tottenham game, same thing again. He went with pace, and I'm happy with it because I understand his thinking.
It's a mentality thing for me, though. What is the mentality that under no circumstances will he take Jeffrey Schlupp off the pitch? And I'm not saying he played particularly badly or anything like that, and I'm not certainly not criticising him for this particular match. But in my opinion, it is going to cost us at some point. And I would really like to have seen that change. I totally agree with getting Andros Townsend on the pitch. But, you know, and Schlupp hadn't actually done anything to deserve being taken off either, by the way, playing in the left hand of the three. I think he'd done very, very well. But if you're going to make that change and not change the system, for me, the obvious sub, you're not going to take Wilf off because he was having a stormer. So for me, the obvious sub is to get Townsend fresh legs, get him on for Jeffrey Schlupp rather than shoehorn Schlupp into midfield. But if you're desperate to take off Coyote because he's tiring or something like that, then put Meyer on, give him 20 minutes. For the love of God, stop with this. Stop this obsession with Jeff.
But I think it's a positive mentality, though. Well, it is because he's not going defensive and he's still going attacking. I think that's what we want to see, especially at home, because it has worked so far this season, though. We are unbeaten in six games. And if you look
at home, they're not unbeaten in six games. I love this. Everyone's really, really keen on sort of really specific statistics at the moment to prove their point. Stop it. Look at all games, look at all matches home and away, look at everything. Doing really well on points per game. If you look at the overall performances in every game this season, quite often we've been shit, that's what I'll say. But I'm happy at the moment.
But we've got the results, so I don't really care about how... Last season we was good, we kept possession, we had lots of shots, but we didn't get the results. I'd rather us be shit and then get the points. And that's what we have at the end of the day. Because now, it's better as it is than it was last season when we were taking lots of shots but couldn't score.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm in a slightly different place with it at the minute. But, I mean, I will vary throughout the course of the season and how I feel. Certainly by the end of the season, I will no doubt be very appreciative of the points we're getting at the moment. But my current gripe is a little bit in terms of... Well, I don't know. I don't want to call it boredom, stagnation. I'm just feeling a little bit, and it's a dangerous way to feel, particularly as a supporter. But anyway, Chris, you've been waiting a while.
Yeah, thanks, Chris. I just wanted to jump in and say a few words in defence of Jeffrey Schlupp because I think he had a good game yesterday, and you know that's anecdotal, but it's based on you know, player watching him for quite a significant period of time. He was in good positions. He was, you know, putting a hell of a lot of energy in, and he made some really good incisive attacking runs. He wasn't just the negative defensive figure that he is sometimes made out to be. And I think he has a lot to offer if he is moved into central midfield at certain opportunities. So, you know, I'd like to see him continue to be given a chance. I think he will be, because Roy is nothing if not stubborn. And, you know, we're going to have to get used to that, frankly. But I also don't think it's the, you know, really hard to justify decision. It may also be that he sees something different in terms of training and endurance and fitness that other players are not, you know, supporting. And, you know, that he knows that the player can do 90 minutes. You just said the same about Ayew, and I would agree with that. You know, it may well be that he's showing that in that endurance in training that means he's got absolute confidence in the player, and that's why he's continuing to pick him and keep him on for 90 minutes.
Yeah, the point really isn't that I'm saying, so you didn't need to defend his performance, because I thought it was, I agree it was a good performance, and I don't think he deserved to be substituted for anything performance related. The point I'm making is that I think, bottom line is, if I'm looking for a central midfielder and my squad is the squad that Roy has at his disposal, Jeffrey Schlupp is not going to be selected as a central midfielder ahead of quite a few of the others, right? That's the bottom line. That's what I'm saying. I completely understand that he's able to do a job there. But I think, as much as Roy says that he's underrated by some and all this kind of stuff, again, I don't underrate him in a position he should be in. I think the manager and staff overrate Jeffrey Schlupp as a footballer in central midfield. And I think if you were to put a different set of management and staff in there, I would find it highly unlikely that any of them would be selecting Jeffrey Schlupp as a central midfielder. I genuinely believe that. I could be completely wrong, and I could be being pig-headed and blind and what have you, and I'll accept that criticism. If you feel that way, that's fine. I just happen to have that opinion. But yeah, I find it a little bit grating, but I don't want it to get lost in the fact I'm not criticising Jeffrey Schlupp, and certainly not for the performance against Norwich, because I think he had a very, very good game.
Okay, so let's get on to the last topic. We've been asked by someone to discuss this, actually. So Pete Trainer, we were on Twitter, a couple of us had reposted some comments about the atmosphere in the ground, and it became a bit of a forum for people's points of view, which, you know, is very divisive. It goes back to, at the very least, last season with the HF and moving and all that kind of stuff, the E400, and we don't need to go over any of that again. But he made this comment, this tweet: "Can you have more stroke some discussion about stuff like this in the pod? As you struggle to find anything positive or optimistic about the team, stroke games, which is making me switch off now. Maybe some more debate about the club in general to incite some points of view." So the implication there is that he'd rather us talk about the atmosphere in the ground than our rank negativity about the club. I mean, I think this probably comes down to that one day that Hambo had a bit too much wine. I think generally we're quite optimistic, or at the very least one of us is optimistic while the other one slags him off. So, yes, thank you for that, Pete. So I thought it was well worth discussing. I think the four of us today are now in the middle of the Lower Hamsdale. So we have had experience of that end of the ground. It seems that a lot of the rest of the ground, and this is particularly people in the Arthur Waite, we don't tend to get that many people commenting from the main stand. So if you'd like to comment more from the main stand, we seem to have a very Arthur Waite heavy, stroke Homesdale heavy listening base. But Arthur season ticket holders have commented that they can hear the HF a hell of a lot less than they could last season when they were in B block or in previous seasons. And some of them have said, well, they can basically hear the away fans now. And that's led other people to say, well, everyone should be making more effort. So I think the question is, to what extent has the atmosphere changed this season? Why has it changed? And is it anything to do with what's on the pitch?
I just want to say this. Look, I don't want to sound rude, but honestly, if the blocky isn't there, and I'm not saying that because I'm in blocky, if it's not there, there's no difference between our ground and the Emirates. It's an absolute library. There was a couple times at near the start of the game where the home side did try to initiate a chant with the Arfa, tried it twice, the Arfa didn't reply, and then tried it again later on and they finally did reply. But when there's moments, when the chant stops, for instance, and you can hear the rest of the ground, it's absolute silence. And it's reached a point where it's just embarrassing right now. And yes, the expectations have changed on the pitch, and people are expecting more now. But it's still, I see that as a very, very, very poor excuse. Like, all right, the expectations has changed, but where's the passion gone? Like, are we not still the same passionate fans that we were when we got promoted to the Premier League, where we were in the Championship? I mean, if something doesn't change, it's very scary where we're heading towards, because right now, I just, like, the main stand is non-existent anyways. Our only hope was the Arfa, and now the Arfa isn't. It seemed like Arthur's gone silent as well. And, you know, it's bad.
I just want to point out that there's an infinite spectrum of people, and you've got people that are naturally boisterous. You've got people right down to people that are very, very shy. And it takes a certain type of person to lead something. And in certain cases, you're going to get people that only really do start singing when other people have, which is perfectly fine. It's natural. So if you take, for example, this comment from James Macy, and there was tons of comments. I'm just taking some out randomly. So from the halfway line in the half away, the HF can hardly be heard in their knee position. It's like being under the concrete of the upper tier, just absorbs the noise. Unfortunately, the move has made the opposite effect, and now the away fans are louder from my seat. So if you take that some people are boisterous and they don't mind just standing up amongst other people, that's fine. But if you need a certain kind of mob effect for the people around James to start singing, it's not necessarily anything to do with the rest of the ground being quiet unlike the Emirates. It's literally an acoustics thing. And it just rubs off. So if it's not rubbing off, then does that mean perhaps E block is not the place and B block was better, or the front of E block, you know, you get people singing more? I think it's a lot deeper issue than just, you know, three quarters of the ground are quiet.
I think the three quarters of the ground being quiet is quite a significant part of the problem. But there is, as you say, also a significant element of just simple, obvious, basic physics that, you know, I've come into the singing section from the far end of the ground. I was in the White Horse before that. And you could barely hear at my end. You could hear the away fans more. That doesn't mean that there was nothing happening in B block. It's well documented. And on the occasions when I occasionally switched seat, I could hear what was happening in the main stand a lot clearer, in the home stand a lot clearer. So it's just one of those things that it will take a while to bed in as well. And also, I think there's probably been a significant migration effect that people wanted to join the singing section and moved from places where they were previously a noisy, boisterous influence that egged other people on. So it will have concentrated things initially. The idea was that it would percolate and generate enthusiasm. We've actually not had that many league home games yet, so it's still plenty of time. So for those of you who aren't happy with the level of noise and support in your area, I'm not going to put it all on you and say that you should be leading that, but do try and encourage others around you to join in and sing, and maybe we can still make this really work all around the ground.
Yeah, there's a lot of a lot I agree with in what you said there, Chris, and in particular the stuff about physics and where people are actually positioned, and Mike's comment about acoustics and whether or not B at the front of B was better than A. I genuinely don't think that's the case. I think some of it, with the greatest respect to people, some of it is agenda driven in what they're saying, and some of it is just true, because, you know, if people move further away from you, you'll hear them less. But I think for me, there's a few things that I'll say. So first of all, if someone wants to tell me it's any different, I was at the back of Block W for quite a significant period of time. and it was very difficult to hear the HF in B as well. All right, and that's why we made quite a lot of noise up there anyway. And we had enough trouble, to be honest, at the back of the Arthur, trying to get W and V to sing in time with each other. You know, so for me, I don't really accept that there's anything other than a positive to come from having a much more coordinated set of fans who want to stand and sing all game. And that's the whole purpose behind it. It's not so people can sit down and sort of take reflected glory and what a great atmosphere it is. If you're sitting there and listening to another group of fans, expecting them to make the noise for you so you can go on Twitter and talk about how great Palace fans are, then, you know, really, I don't like that. But for those of you who are just finding it harder to get involved in the noise, unfortunately, as Chris was suggesting, that's the shame of it. Less, you know, fewer people are going to be around in the kind of less noisy areas because they've migrated to that area to join like-minded fans. And unfortunately, maybe you should, I don't know if you were, if you tried to go with them or not, but you know, bottom line is it's for others to step up as well, because you know, it has died in other areas of the ground. But I do think that that's kind of what happens in the Premier League. DR was suggesting it, you know, if you take out Blocky, I'm not saying we'll have a silent set of fans. There were so many passionate fans all over the ground, but collectively, to make enough noise, to sing in time, all those things that make for a great atmosphere, is very, very tough. If there's two or three of you in pockets and that kind of stuff. So difficult. But I would just say that if you can't hear other people, what are you doing about it? Just try and think like that. If you buy into it, or it just, everything just dies on its ass and we can all sit eating our prawn sandwiches.
Yeah, I mean, that pretty much sums it up. There was points in the game, there's points in all the home games I've been to actually, where it did suddenly start feeding around the whole of the home stale seemed to get involved, and then it fed around to the Arthur. So I would imagine that as if and when football is decent on the pitch, people will get more involved as well. So I'm sure it'll only grow outwards. And it's an idea the HF have floated, the club have gone with, and I think they're keen to see if it works. There's obviously been some alienation in terms of, I don't, people have been moaning about the large flags and not being able to see, and that's going to make them go quieter and possibly resent the fact that they're near the HF area. But that is just how it is, and I don't think you can complain, because it was something that was talked about by Steve Parish and the club for a very long time, with the HF to make a singing section, and they've decided that that's the best thing to get the ground going more. We're going to give it a whole season, so I think take a longer period. Like Chris said, you can't really go after four home games. You can't really decide how things have gone. After the first four games last season, it was an absolute library, but it ended up sorting itself out. So I'm sure the same thing will happen this season. We do have a few listener comments that we haven't covered.
I'll say, Max, I'm really sorry. You actually asked us a really interesting question, and it was going to be a topic all of its own, but not this week. We've run out of time. It'll be on the Your View podcast. We'll maybe try and pick up on it later on. It was just a general point, kind of about the extremes that people are going to, in the, you know, we lose and everything's a disaster and the club's rubbish, or and we win and everything's great and Roy's a genius, and how we're kind of flitting between the two, which I think would have been an interesting debate, but we can pick up on that another time. And obviously there's a couple more comments as well, Mike.
I mean, that subject is going to come up again, isn't it? We can come back to that probably every week. One very interesting point, and I mean, it was mentioned on the Sky highlights. So Palace Ash has just said, "Fortress Selhurst again?" ? So 8 points from four games.
It's been a while since we've talked about Fortress Selhurst, isn't it? And you know, the good signs there. We just want to make sure that the away form doesn't drop off to match the home form from last year. If we can actually get the home and away form up to a really positive level, we can stop being selective about statistics and start looking up the table, can't we?
There's an interesting stat from producer Mikey, who I feel like I haven't chatted to since time immemorial, because it seems to be Sam doing all the producing on all the shows I'm doing. But he pointed out that in the last two seasons, it took us at least 10 games longer than it's taken this season to get to three wins. So, you know, two of those have come at home. No defeats at home. Yeah, I mean, it's looking good, but I don't think we've played quite enough games to be talking about that yet. No. And the other comment from Kevin Tua. Kuate was awful.
Well, I mean, we've all got opinions, haven't we? I'm fully behind, I'll be honest.
Yeah, interesting. I mean, he seemed to do a lot of running with the ball yesterday. But I did notice he ran himself into some cul-de-sacs. But he did seem to... He kept the ball for longer periods, I think, than perhaps somebody who'd have taken his place in midfield would have done. But he took the pressure off a lot of players in the sort of way that Zaha does, that I hadn't seen Kuate do too much. So I was quite impressed with him. I thought his end product was lacking a little bit, but I think it's one of those things. Kuate does that job, or one of those jobs, that it's almost impossible to define exactly what he does. Johan Kabay, I remember chatting when I first started the pod plenty of times, and the big days when some of us thought he was useless and others thought he was really good. When you got one of those players that you can't really define what they do, they just do it, and they seem to do it game in, game out. So it's difficult because none of us are footballers, none of us are managers. We're making comments based on the fact that we're drunkenly watching some football. Kuate is a tough one to define.
Indeed. Well, thank you so much to everybody who got in touch. Again, we haven't used it all because we simply can't. Well, this podcast will be about 8 hours long, and I'd have even less time to do the work I've got to do before I fly to Glasgow tomorrow. So anyway, thank you, for listening, getting in contact. Do share and subscribe the podcast. Rate us 5 stars on your chosen podcast app. Check out the Love Sports Show Tuesday, 8 till 9 p.m. And also the preview show, which should be out, I assume, Thursday. Something like that anyway. Always a good laugh, and some lovely insightful comments from the lads on that too. And that'll be it. We'll be back next week. Cheers. Bye.
It's the 90th minute. All your mates are round. You've got your McNugget share boxes ready to go. Your mates already got booked for double dipping, and you steal the last nugget, snatching all 3 points. Perfect. Order McDelivery now on the McDonald's app. You in? At participating restaurants, 18 plus, serving times, delivery fee and terms apply. See mcdonalds.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
This podcast is proud to be part of the TalkSport Fan Network. TalkSport. Powered by fans.